Come on. Let's get this over with.
Hello, everybody. This is A Get With This. Melrose Place. Season 4, Episode 32, Dead Sisters Walking. And now, here are your hosts.
Tara Aranio and Sarah D. Bunting. Hello, Sarah.
Hello, Tara and Dove. How are you?
Oh, I'm making myself comfortable for a very long episode. This is our season finale, which means it is...
We did it!
It's two hours. I mean, ooh. 1 hour, 22, or whatever. But it's double the length what we're normally given, fortunately.
But same amount of content.
You know, it really is.
Oh, man, it just took so long to get to the fireworks factory. Anyway.
It did. It really did. Anyway, before we get into that, I want to tell you what's happening on our Patreon episode 84, dropping February 18th. Let's watch Brian Austin Green in Sabrina the Teenage Witch. This is season 1, episode 6 of Sabrina, titled Dream Date. It is on Hulu. We will link that in the show notes. And if you want to hear us talk all about that, join us at patreon.com/againwiththis.
Also, next week in the main feed, we will not quite yet be moving on to season 5, episode 1. First, we are going to do Beverly Hills 90210 Secondary Character Thunderdome. In case you are not familiar with these, this is how it works. Characters, TV concepts, etc. and so on, enter the Thunderdome in groups of 3. Only one will leave. Whichever one leaves proceeds to the next round, and so on until a champion is crowned.
Yes.
We will be doing this with secondary characters from Beverly Hills 90210. Like I said, that will drop in the normal slot. That's on Monday, February 21st. And then we will return to Melrose for season 5 on Monday, February 28th. Hope you'll join us for all of that.
Indeed. All right. Let us get into this supersized finale, starting with our C plot. Are Joe and Dr. O'Malley meant to be? Also, Matt's a pillhead now. So... Joe and Jake visit Matt in the hospital to catch up the brand new viewers on what his deal is right now. As you all know already, he has meningitis. Matt says he's missing school and has a test, and Jake is like, he's out of it, but he is currently a student who takes tests. Like, what is that? Why is that indicated that he's out of anything? Shut up, Jake.
Yeah.
In the hall, Joe admits to Jake that she didn't want to believe that Matt could actually die, but she is as scared of that as Matt himself is. And just as Jake is comforting Joe with a hug, Dr. O'Malley looks up the hall and gets all clenched about it and just glares as they leave together, as is his way, unfortunately. And in bed at her place that night, Joe is so obviously... not engaged in the sex she is currently having, that even the famously obtuse Dr. O'Malley has to comment. Clip 2.
Okay, I can take a hint. You're not into this.
Wow.
Yeah. Take a hint from us. You suck. Please leave. And please don't take so long to do that.
Yeah. Joe admits she's worried about Matt, but he says Matt's fever broke, he'll be fine. Dr. O'Malley suspects she's actually thinking about someone else and takes forever to say that he saw her with Jake. And when she laughs that they're just friends, he asks if Jake has only ever been a friend, and she dodges, saying she's turned on seeing him seem like he's not in control for once. And if Dr. O'Malley comes back to bed, they can take turns being in control. Ooh, but just a note... given events that come up later, if he doesn't already know that Joe and Jake were previously involved, like, you guys definitely have not been together long enough to be serious.
Yeah.
In my opinion.
Also, the scene that ensues is supposed to be sexy, but it's so boring.
Yeah.
O'Malley is the worst.
Yeah.
Such a just shitty little baby. And I know he's like, cast for Beefcake, but even that, I'm just like, you're ugh.
Yeah, when he smiles, it like only his eyes kind of crinkle, and he's just like, looks like he's showing his teeth, like he's not it.
Yeah, a lot of hoint faces that are supposed to be acting, which, like, I get that it's a soap, but
Yeah.
You should not be in the same league as Billy and still be working, I'm just saying.
No. So anyway, the next day, Matt's still in the hospital, but doing much better when Joe comes to see him. And when he claims he never feared death, with the doctor as good as Dr. O'Malley supervising his care, which I thought he was a pediatrician, but
thank
okay.
you.
Right? And, like, that was the whole
pediatric
point.
Psychologist, right? I mean, like, I think he's a, you know, like medical doctor, but
right.
I thought he was
specialized,
you know,
in abuse cases. Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, Joe's like, yeah, that's what he keeps telling me, that Dr. Manley's like saying he's great. And Joe has a feeling that he's hiding something. Matt tries to assure her that Dr. O'Malley is different from any other trash guy Joe's ever dated, which, like, harsh but fair.
Yeah.
So Joe comes to Dr. O'Malley's place for the very first time. Again, another sign you are not ready to be serious. She's there to have dinner. There are stacks of boxes here and there that she does not get a chance to ask about, because as soon as they toast, he blurts that he thinks they should get married. And after she's done choking on her wine, this happens. Clip 3.
We barely know each other.
4 weeks, 2 days.
Don't do that. Don't pull that Mr. Romantic crap on me.
You know, you're not making this very easy.
Why the hell should I? Whatever happened to slowing down?
I can't. I love you, and you love me, don't you?
I don't know what I feel. I don't know, and I don't even know if I would trust you enough to tell you if I did know. I think I'm leaving.
Come here.
Big kiss.
Don't you tell me you don't trust that.
I want more than chemistry.
Okay, well, you should want chemistry because y'all have none. That's A. B,
yeah.
This is in the visual aids, but she, you know that scene in Superman 2 where it's like at the end and Clark Kent, who basically now she knows, Lois knows it's Superman, and he's like, no, we can't be together. And he basically gives her a memory wipe kiss and she's standing there just like swaying.
Yeah.
For like 10 full seconds after that. And then, you know, the editor's like, yo, Scoop, what's your problem? And then she forgot everything that happened.
Does Superman just sort of like Rohypnol Lois Lane? That's what it sounds like. Like, he put stuff on his lips and kissed her and she's like, ah. Sounds kind of rapey.
Maybe. Although she, like, they had already done it. She was consenting. And then I guess she was like really sad that she could not have, you know, super dick out in the open. And then this was to like do her an emotional favor to wipe her memory. I don't know.
Look, I don't like Kevin Smith as much as the next guy doesn't like Kevin Smith. But he was right when he said, if Superman and Lois Lane have sex, it would kill Lois Lane.
Oh, no. I agree with that also.
Okay.
I just had a PS to Dave's question. It would be Rohypnol. Thank you.
Oh. Anyway, this is how Joe is standing after Dominic O'Malley kisses her. She's just like swaying like Lois Lane in the newsroom at the end of Superman 2.
Mm-hmm.
There is absolutely no way that he is that good at anything.
No.
Including kissing. Like, I mean, we're supposed to believe that, like, they have something more than her being dickmatized, but
right.
I don't.
So.
And there's so much arm grabbing in this plot line, too. And in all of them this week.
It's
horrible.
True. So the next day, Dr. O'Malley is advising Matt to take it easy, but Matt is getting ready to leave so that he can catch up on school. And Joe shows up just in time for Matt to leave against medical advice. Once he's gone, Dr. O'Malley asks if Joe's ready to accept his proposal yet, and under duress, she declines, and he bitterly accepts it and starts to go. She says she still wants to date him. He's just moving too fast, and he's like, not for me. Whatever. He's kind of right. Once a proposal is out on the table and someone declines, that's kind of it. You can't go backwards.
Kelly Taylor, it is. We have talked about this before.
We sure have. So at the library, a classmate named Greg sees Matt nodding off over his book, which we'll get back to, and tells him to take speed. Matt declines, but Greg says Matt will change his mind in a few hours and puts one loose pill on his open book.
Miniature Altoid.
Thank you. Looks exactly like the ones that David stole from his dad, which is to say, as we said at the time, like an Altoid. Like, you know, we've all seen a pill, but even if you haven't, if you watch Dope Sick, you know, like, they have things printed on them. Like, even Excedrin has something on it. Just like, yeah. Chalky. Come on, guys.
Yeah.
The other thing is that, and we both noticed this in the visual aid, so you can see it. They show a close up of the book when Greg leaves the pill on it, and it's like a history book. The paragraph is about Marxism. Like this,
yeah.
You couldn't find a medical book.
Yeah, like the Hegelian dialectic. Like, oh yeah. My God, really?
Come on.
Nothing in that Books by the Foot shipment. That's like Stedman's Medical Dictionary. Just even I owned that because I was recapping ER. What a nerd.
Oh my God. But yeah, yeah. Send a PA to like the library. They can return it that night. It's not hard.
It's a close up.
Yeah. Seems to be about politics in the Catholic Church as far as I could tell. But anyway, go check it out in the visual aids. You tell us. And as Matt regards the pill, he has a lot to think about. The next day, Joe goes to Dr. Malley's place, finds it even more full of boxes and also movers now because he's going to Bosnia for a year to work with orphans, and it's been in the works for months. Joe is furious that he made her fall in love with her under the circumstances, but he says if she loves him, why won't she marry him? And she mentions her career, her friends, the fact that he kept this huge thing a secret from her. But he thought it would be a great opportunity for both of their careers, but there's no point talking about it because he's moving on and maybe she should too. Which, sidebar, not to say that Joe could not transition to, like, photojournalism or something. We know she's done that before, but, like, her career right now, as far as we know, is advertising photography. So,
yeah,
I'm not sure, you know.
Also, the reason that there are orphans to work with in Bosnia is that it was an active war zone.
Right.
Like,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Everything about this is a horrible idea, and he's not cute or nice enough to justify it.
Yeah.
But here we all are.
And Joe agrees with us because she slaps him hard and tells him to go ahead. And when we see her next, she's having a classic sad single gal day. Sweats, couch, blanket, ice cream. We're supposed to think she's gazing out the window, but the shutters are closed. Like, I don't know what she's gazing at. But that's the scene, as you can see in the visual aids, when he shows up and leans in her doorway. He was wrong to assume that she would leave her life for him, but he was acting out of love, and now he's going. His plane leaves in a few hours. And she says he should spend that time with her because it's the past, and you don't have to be at the airport a few hours before your flight to Bosnia. And they kiss. And back at the hospital, a loudly yawning Matt asks a harried desk nurse to get one of his patients her meds, and the nurse, who is slammed, tells him to go do it and gives him her keys to the drug lockup, and we know how this goes.
Mm-hmm.
But in case we didn't, Matt runs into his pill connect, Greg, and exposits that he's been trying to find him for a re-up, but Greg is out. Good thing Matt's in a hospital. And then Matt opens the drug closet and helps himself to some Dexedrine because I guess after he finishes studying, he's going to Studio 54 in 1977. Honest to God.
I was going to say Andy Warhol's factory in 1967, but sure.
Either way. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then it's time for Dr. O'Malley to get to the airport. And he's valiantly refusing Joe's offer to drive him because he hates public goodbyes and doesn't want this all to be any harder than it already is. And when he walks out, she runs after him, but then just stays outside her door and is like, bye. Then we're at LAX. Dr. O'Malley calls Joe on a payphone but gets her machine. His flight is called. But then Joe is there at the gate because it's the past and that could still happen then. She's saying it doesn't feel right for him to leave. And he says she should come and she says he should stay. He has to board. So he tells her to go home for her passport, fly to New York, and they'll leave from there together. And left alone, she sobs and she also has a lot to think about. Or does she? This feels very like, well, we'll see how contract talks go, whether
sure
Joe's going to be here next year or not. So
yeah. Hope they fell through with that guy because not a positive addition to the cast.
No.
Go to Bosnia, don't come back.
Yeah. Moving on to our B plot. Peter's mental health journey takes some sharp left turns.
Mm-hmm.
We rejoin Peter exactly where we left off. Betsy going in with the drill, but just in time, Dave, the orderly, runs in to say two people have broken into the hospital, claiming to be Kimberly's friends. And Betsy looks out to see Michael and Amanda and sternly tells Dave they are not her friends and orders Nurse Benson to suture Peter and remove him. And Betsy then tells Dave that Michael and Amanda are escaped mental patients, which I feel like this guy would know who is and is not a mental patient. Even if this is a crooked hospital, like, you would know, right?
Yeah. I just...
Like, Peter himself only got admitted because she drugged him. And he was, like, barely standing when they got there.
I mean, it's all such a, like... farcical caper, and it's played so farcically, except at certain times when you're actually supposed to care slash think something bad is going to happen. Like, the tone of this whole plot is extremely odd. Thomas Calabro seems to be the only one who knows exactly what he's supposed to be doing, and he's doing it. Like,
I think Heather Locklear does too.
Yeah. I mean, not that Jack Wagner doesn't, but it's just like impossible. Like, it's very melodramatic and, like, campy.
Yes.
I mean, which is fine, but it also takes a really long time. Like, there just wasn't that much material that they needed 2 hours.
It's true.
In my opinion.
I agree. So, anyway, they end it with Betsy telling Dave to follow her lead. And so she starts by calmly lying that she doesn't know where Peter is. She's in charge. She's asking Michael and Amanda to go. And Amanda says that if Kimberly doesn't cooperate, Amanda will have the medical board investigate the facility, which, like, you can try. Ew. I think we've already seen that doesn't go anywhere. Mm. But Betsy was prepared for this eventuality. Clip 4.
All right. Peter is here. He came here to avoid prosecution. And as his friend, I've agreed to help him.
Are you saying he skipped out for good?
He's an innocent man. Why would he do that?
Ask him yourself. I'll take you to him.
So now Dave is standing right there. He has heard these people who know him call him Peter, which she has refused to do. She's like, this is his delusion. His name is Mr. Peters.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you'd think he'd be like, wait, what is this guy's name? But he doesn't. He has questions later. That's not one of them.
No.
So Betsy gives Dave a significant look as she tells Michael and Amanda to follow her. For some reason, they do. And just as she's about to lock them in a cell, she gets too cocky and gloats about it. She can also see in the visual aids with her being like, suckers! So Michael pushes the door back open, launches himself at the orderlies, and tells Amanda to run for it. Betsy hits the alarm, orders her minions to search the whole joint for them. And you can see this in the visual aids. She also, of course, understands the assignment, but she's like, after them, with her, like, arm straight out.
Meanwhile, in the foreground, a man is merrily playing an upright piano while a Chiron is like, but hark, our heroes have escapeth.
It's very cartoony.
Mm-hmm.
So when we next see Willowbridge, the camera follows Michael and Amanda's voices to let us know they somehow got into a very large heating duct. It's too bad Amanda did not bring her mobile phone on this trip. Mm. Michael is not optimistic about their chances of escaping a mental institution on lockdown, and he doesn't want anyone hurt. And Dave wanders in just then and is about to leave when Amanda loudly gasps at a rat by her foot. And Dave follows the sound, but by the time he gets there, they've somehow silently crawled around the bend to escape detection. Also, the vent cover is just a flap. Like, it's not nailed down or anything, and Dave seems very whatever about there being vermin in the duct that could probably get out that way if it wanted to, but, you know, whatever, I guess. At that night, Peter is strapped in a wheelchair in the day room, trying not to let himself nod off. Michael and Amanda have acquired bathrobes and are trying to blend in, and Peter recognizes Amanda. Louis very nicely goes to bring her back to Peter, but does not explain what he's doing, and Michael has to put down the totally unattended phone he is about to dial in the day room and intervene. Again, very up and down the security of this place. So,
yeah. I guess they really rely on Thorazine to do 80% of their work for them, but
yes,
okay.
And the honor system. But eventually, everyone meets each other. Peter doesn't think he can walk, so Amanda wheels him out, and Louis, at increasing volume, whines that it's against the rules, drawing the attention of Nurse Benson. Enter Betsy, right in their path. Clip 5.
End of the line, psychos.
Thought we might need that for later.
Mm-hmm.
Also,
yep,
just funny. The next day, Betsy's telling Dave and another orderly named Ziggy, that representatives are coming from a hospital in Arizona to collect their patients, Michael and Amanda. And Dave is not so sure about this because he checked their IDs and saw one of them's a doctor. Betsy says it's fake and does not care that Ziggy doesn't think Amanda looks crazy, which, okay, not sure that's really what you're clocking on Amanda so much when you look at her, but fine.
Yeah, she doesn't have the crazy boobs, man. I've been doing this job a long time. You could tell.
By the way, neither guy asks why patients who escaped one mental hospital would then break into another mental hospital again with the logic.
Yeah, or whether being kept in the boiler room, but we'll get
to it. Well, yes, only the three of them can know where they actually are, the boiler room, which we're about to find out. But then Nurse Benson appears to tell Betsy she doesn't know where Peter is. Betsy huffs that she had him moved away from Nurse Benson, who should be grateful, and she also claims Michael and Amanda just left, but they're in the boiler room. Amanda, in particular, feeling uncharitable toward their captor, clip six.
Woman should be locked up for life.
Well, she was.
Yeah.
Until your boy, sprang her and gave her therapy, which didn't work. I think Michael has a line shortly after this that where he's blaming this all on Peter. And it's like, well, yes, but not for the reasons you think. Like, does anyone remember that she was in state custody for felonies, plural?
Yeah.
No, like maybe if you just let that happen. And again, I get it. I live in the world. I know they tried to give Marcia Cross something to do. But oh boy, like every time they're like, no, she's really crazy. Like there was a solution to this that was already in progress.
It's true.
You could have just left her there. But yeah.
Yeah. And I also just want to say as a viewer of White Collar, like even if the state was like, eh, we give up, you would think the insurance company that covers the complex would be like, no.
Yeah.
We don't want to pay out on this shit. Like charge her, try to recoup whatever we had to pay from her.
Yeah.
Anyway. Michael feels Kimberly needs help. Amanda and Peter think she's past it. Michael is remarkably unfazed to hear how Betsy was about to lobotomize Peter before they showed up, but then insists that he loves Kimberly and is not giving up on her. Peter says Kimberly's gone and Betsy wants to keep it that way. Sure does seem like it.
Mm-hmm.
That night, the orderlies tell Betsy they think that Peter and Co. should be in a cell, not the boiler room, but Betsy says they've never had a murderer at the hospital before. Which, how would she know? She's only been there a week, but she wanted to keep that secret. Nurse Benson appears just then and hears as Betsy adds that Michael and Amanda were involved in a hostage situation in Arizona. Dave thinks he would have heard about that on the news, but Betsy says it was so grisly, the hospital had to cover up what they did to those hospital staffers. And Ziggy thinks the patients at least need to eat. Betsy has an answer for that, too. They're scheduled for surgery. Dave thought the Arizona people were picking them up, and Betsy's like, oh, right, well, they want me to lobotomize them first. Then she asks if they question Dr. Tucker
like
this much.
Like they're foster animals that they're offering to...
Getting spayed.
Oh, God.
Yeah. Yep.
Complimentary spay and neuter. Oh, boy. All right.
So Dave, also very cowed, apologizes and scolds Ziggy, and Betsy breathes an actual visible sigh of relief, which you can see in the visual aids. And back in the boiler room, Michael tells Peter and Amanda to quit pacing. Michael blames Peter for causing Kimberly to flip out by making demands about his alibi, which gave control of the body to Betsy. Amanda counters that Michael has driven Kimberly closer to insanity the whole time he's known her than Peter ever has. Fair point.
Yep, true. No notes.
Amanda starts having trouble breathing, but she follows Michael up a ladder to a catwalk anyway. And whatever that is, even though heat rises, Peter apologizes to Amanda for everything. Michael's sorry, too. Enter Nurse Benson, who isn't sure why she came, and repeats Betsy's whole story about who Michael and Amanda are. Amanda and Michael insist that Kimberly is the one who's crazy. Nurse Benson's starting to agree. Feel like that's not a word that we should be using, given the setting. Also, when one of you is a doctor and one of you is a psychiatric nurse, but whatever.
There's also repeated references to the loony bin, the nut house, the crazy house. Like, it's just a very, like, are we in a Charlie Chaplin short? Fine.
Right. I mean, as you said, it is very campy. Like, it's, you know, it's not fruitful to be like, they should be more respectful of differences in cognition or whatever. Like, this is, you know, this is, it's not the place. Anyway, the fact that Nurse Benson is starting to be on their side is why it's too bad Kimberly's planning to lobotomize all of them in the boiler room. Peter appeals to Nurse Benson's duty to get her to let them out. And no sooner has she done so than Betsy enters with Dave in tow. Michael gently asks Kimberly to let Peter and Amanda go because he loves her. Betsy tells him to call her by that name. He will not, and insists their love is worth fighting for. Betsy doesn't want Kimberly to be loved, but Michael does, and nothing will ever change that. And he screams in Betsy's face for Kimberly to come back, and it works. And she falls onto his shoulder.
It's not your fault.
Yeah.
Ugh.
She falls on his shoulder, crying for him to help her. Dave doesn't know what kind of medicine this is, but Michael needs to let go of the doctor and step back. And Kimberly tells Dave she's fine and that he should let them all go, but Michael isn't leaving without Kimberly. Cue another struggle, during which Dave gets to the alarm, knocking Kimberly into the metal screen in the process, and she falls. Dave and Michael fight. Nurse Benson leads Amanda and Peter to the door. Ziggy gives chase, but Louie knocks him down in vengeance for all the times Ziggy made him miss dinner. Oh, Ziggy, will you ever win? And Nurse Benson gives Peter her key. Amanda reminds us all the cops are coming, so Peter can't be there. And Kimberly comes to as Dave is choking Michael out. She yanks Dave off Michael. Not sure about the physics of this. He is a large man. Mm-hmm. I mean, she's tall, but she's not big. Dave shoves her back. She flips a lever or whatever and blasts hot steam in Dave's face. But then they both fall off the catwalk to the floor below. That's the end of part one.
It's no Doug Savant at the end of Masquerade, but it's pretty good artful arranging of the fallen.
It is good. Yeah. So that would have been in the, you know, as it airs, that's the end of part one. So after the commercials, mm-hmm. Michael's accompanying Kimberly's gurney in at Wilshire Memorial and reporting what happened to the ER doctor. Kind of a long way to go. They were in Sacramento. Like, they couldn't go to a hospital there? Okay.
Yeah, it's the state capital. I'm pretty sure there's an ER there, but sure.
Probably. What we did not see was that Dave's body broke Kimberly's fall, LOL. Not sure what happened to him. I guess they left him there. Michael's just stepped out when Detective Willis accosts him to talk about Peter, and Michael is like, is now the time? And even Willis is like, fine, you're right.
Yeah.
Cut to Amanda's place where she lets herself in and sees that Peter's there hiding, wearing what are apparently Matt's sweats. She gets straight to it in light of what Michael's told her about Willis at the hospital. Amanda thinks Peter should leave the country, but he's not leaving everything behind, especially her. And he knows that Kimberly remembers that dinner they had. And if she doesn't, he can make her, which he can. I think screaming and face therapy might only work that one time we saw.
Mm-hmm.
But reluctantly, Amanda agrees to take him to the hospital. She wants him in her life, whatever she has to do. And then Kimberly's waking up in the hospital, apologizing to Michael again. Amanda leads in Peter, incognito in his baseball cap, which, like, you see this in the visual aids, too. It looks super weird. Even before you get close enough to see, it's, like, barely perched upon his head. Like, this is doing nothing to disguise his identity.
And then he kicks it back so that it's, yeah, like, almost like this boy band situation, and it's just super distracting throughout the mm-hmm. scene as well. By this point in the season, Jack Wagner kind of needed a haircut, and it just uh-huh. is so, it's such an aggressive dad cap, and it's clearly like someone was sent out to like the dollar store to get one of those chintzy ones with like the rope across the brim. It's so yes. bad, guys.
Yeah,
so bad. Like mm-hmm. even Tony La Russa is like, this is, that's too much hat. It's too much baseball hat. Yeah,
so Kimberly apologizes to Peter too, and he's like, whatever, whatever, that dinner, but she can't think. And then some snitch nurse is leaving in Detective Willis and a uniformed cop to arrest Peter. How did she even recognize him? Just kidding. And when we next see Peter, Amanda's visiting him in jail. Kimberly's still out of it. He's being arraigned in the morning, and he says Amanda needs to walk away from him. And outside, Amanda's set upon by Detective Willis. They found records in Alicia's car. They did, because I'm pretty sure it was smushed and probably on fire.
Yeah, that was like a yeah, that was a crushed beer can of a vehicle at the end. So whatever.
But apparently these records he may or may not have show that Alicia and Peter set up Bobby. Amanda says Alicia framed Peter. Somehow Willis knows that Peter told Amanda that he did it. She says anything Peter told her was confidential, which it's not, as he goes on to tell her. And he says she would have to tell the grand jury what Peter said. And she states that she won't be testifying to a grand jury. And he's like, well, you actually definitely will. And then Michael's leading Kimberly in for surgery on her burst spleen. She is still racked with guilt over everything and doesn't think she deserves to live or for him to love her, but he assures her otherwise. And back to jail, Peter would not look at her at the arraignment we did not see. He can barely look at her now either. She catches him up on everything and he tells her not to perjure herself for him, but also, clip 7.
Peter, I talked to your lawyer. A wife doesn't have to testify against her husband. Marry me.
What?
I said I want you to marry me.
No! I mean, why? Why? Because you feel sorry for me? Because you think it might help me?
You have pursued me relentlessly for months. And now I want to get married and you're not interested? I mean, you still love me, don't you?
More than anything. That's why you deserve more than conjugal visits to a husband who's behind bars. I don't want you to come back here. And if you do, I won't see you.
I mean, if you get conjugal visits, what's the problem? Like, if this caper works, you won't have to worry about it. But if they send you to the trailer at Lompoc, what's the big deal?
Also,
how long do you need, buddies? Heather Locklear.
Honest to God. But the other thing is, like, she was the one who was like, I think you should leave the country. And he's like, I'm not leaving you. And all of a sudden, he is. So,
yeah, like, I won't see you. Like, don't be such a drama queen.
Yes.
That's ridiculous. It's
also
fine.
Who wouldn't want to see her? She is adorable.
Exactly. However, Jack Wagner's delivery of no, like, why? Like, it's so bizarre. This whole plot is tonally like a bottle rocket in a Volkswagen. It's very bizarre.
Mm-hmm.
But there are little moments of joy in it, and this is one of them.
It's true. The next day, a guard brings Peter to a meeting with his attorney, but Amanda's also there in an understated white dress to marry him. Mm-hmm. When Peter protests again, Amanda's basically like, this is happening, deal with it. And even Peter's lawyer's like, bro, she's right. So Peter checks that this is really what she wants and then signs the wedding license. And then they are wed. They only get to kiss a couple of times before Peter's led back off again. And then Kimberly wakes up to Michael sitting on the edge of her bed. You can see this shot in the visual aid. It's so cute. He is really adorable in this moment, like just gazing at her as she wakes up. Love him. Her surgery went well, but she wants Michael to tell Peter she'll testify as soon as she's well enough. He tells her to get some rest. And then her heart monitor goes flat and Michael orders a code blue. And in jail, a mean guard tells Peter in his cell to enjoy his honeymoon. Rude. And at her place, Amanda takes a break from gazing at her marriage certificate to open the door to Detective Willis and smugly tell him that she and Peter got married. And he's like, great, but clipping.
Well, there's been a development in your husband's case.
So, are you letting Peter out of jail?
Well, that's kind of tough because Peter Burns isn't in jail.
I don't understand. I just left him there.
Can you identify this man?
Snapshot of some guy.
No, I've never seen him before.
That's odd because this is the real Dr. Peter Burns. I don't know who you're married to.
Gasp!
I mean, I said this like 2 seasons ago that I was like, does someone want to double check that sister story? You should listen to me, people in the box, but you never do. You never do.
The cliff. We hang. Let's close things up with our A plot. Jake's attempt at matchmaking fails, sort of, while Jane and Sydney find a common purpose. I'm not going to clip it. But the song that plays over the blessedly very long B-roll is apparently a real song performed by Sting. It's Let Your Soul Be Your Pilot.
Yeah. I Shazammed that and was like, oh my God.
What I was like, happened? That sounds like Sting.
What happened?
So this led me to find a Spotify playlist of the real Melrose music, which we have linked in the show notes if you want to check that out. After all that, we're in a park where Jane is feeding birds and continuing to make the case for killing Richard. Sydney is in a graphic, like, dot-printed top, which is extremely cute. You can see in the visual aids. I was into it. It's a little bit tea towel-y, but that was the style at the time, and I'm from the 90s also, so I was I liked it.
She had an excellent top episode.
She did.
The sleeveless ringer, which I wish they would come back in. She had that sort of 40s-esque, like long-waisted, like ribbed and then blousey on the top. Double V blouse. This will all be in the visual aids, but like I think someone finally was like, she's starting to look like divine and we need to pull this back a little bit. And they did. And she looks adorable.
She does. So Sydney tries to get out of this by citing biblical commandments, like, we're not new to knowing you, Sydney, but good try. So she switches to pragmatism. Murder is a capital crime in California at this point in history. Then she switches back to the Bible. She's worried about Jane's soul ending up in hell. But Jane doesn't believe in hell, just in the devil, whom Sydney's going to help her kill. All right. At the studio, Jane walks in on the end of Richard on the phone yelling at his contractor, which is how she hears he's using the back door to avoid wet cement. Sidebar. I forgot about this. Her studio in the garage. Now that she's fallen out with Jake, did she lose that place? Is Joe parking there again? I don't think we ever find out.
Or is she just like going back into the Hart Mancini offices, which are now Hart Mancini again? Like, yeah. I don't even know what's going on.
Anyway, she just had sketches to drop off, but he decides to get creepy. He misses seeing her outside of work. And she vaguely says that she misses him too. And he wants a kiss and promises he won't bite this time. Yuck.
Yeah. Some really eloquent, I am millimeters from vomiting faces from Josie Bassett in this episode. Well done.
Absolutely. So she pecks him on the cheek. He calls her a good girl, also gross, and leaves. But first, clip 9.
Oh, and Jane, next time, on the lips.
Next time won't be on the lips, Richard. It'll be between the eyes.
I mean, he's not a good actor, but he's definitely, like, if they're trying to sell us on the wisdom of offing him, he's doing a good job.
He is. He's committing to this narrative, for sure. Also, before the end of the scene, she takes a few pages of checks out of the checkbook on his desk from the back. At Shooters, Billy recaps his bad date with Allison. Jake doesn't think it's a big deal that he got a little drunk, which Jake wouldn't, but Billy notes that a recovering alcoholic might feel differently. And Allison enters just then, looking annoyed that they're obviously talking about her. Jake says Billy has something to tell her, and she asks him to knock off the matchmaking. But when Jake leaves, Allison aggressively tells Billy to go ahead, and we all wish he hadn't, clipped in.
Well, I wasn't quite ready to discuss this, but since it's come up, just wanted you to know that I'm making amends with all the people that I've burned.
Billy, you don't know the first thing about making amends.
I've happened to have learned from your experience in AA.
Give me a break.
I'm not doing this for you, okay? I'm doing this so that maybe I can feel a little bit better about myself, so give me some credit for that.
No.
This is all very admirable.
No, it isn't.
But you should know, this probably isn't going to change my feelings for you.
Well, key word, probably.
I have to go punch in.
So? I think I got my foot back in the door.
I got a foot for you. Also, I think she forgot the name of the character. It's not Jen, sweetheart. It's Jane. But, you know.
I mean, I heard Jin, so, okay.
Oh, that might make sense. Yeah.
Maybe that's me projecting. I just, like, everything about this, like, she doesn't want it, both of you.
Yeah.
So stop with the fucking matchmaking. This is not what amends are about.
No.
Dickhead. Stop appropriating that shit.
Yes.
And then being like, give me some credit for making this about myself and not how you feel.
Right.
That's not how that works either.
It's not.
Oh, my God. Like, I just, and this is another one that's like, we don't see Billy for long stretches of time. And then he comes back in and we're supposed to be like rooting for this great love. But it's like the rest of the time he's like in a charger somewhere. Like it's just very structured, very bizarrely. Like just get Allison and Jake together and make this an hour and a half. Like we don't need to be stalled out in this plot line. With one hilarious exception, which we will get to.
Yes. I don't think we are supposed to be rooting for him. I think we're supposed to think he's a chump. Like, we're supposed to be taking our cues from Allison, I believe, and her disgust.
Right. But it's just, it's just very odd that, like, he's like, I'm doing all this work on myself. It's like, well, then why isn't the show showing that? Oh, yeah, they don't care either. Like, well, then what are we doing here with any of it? I don't know.
Yeah. The whole thing about, like, well, I learned a thing or two from you about amends, you know. Like, first of all, no, you didn't. And second, I've also been watching Single Drunk Female on Freeform, which is very good, by the way. And it's only a half hour, if that's unlike this monstrosity. But the story, the plot is basically there's this girl, she's gotten out of rehab, she's trying to stay sober, and it's about how that is hard. She's a young woman in her, you know, her 20s. She's lost her job, lost everything, has moved back in with her mother, played by Ally Sheedy. And in the second episode, she decides she needs to get back in with her friends by making amends to them. And her sponsor, who's played by Rebecca Henderson from Inventing Anna, Sarah, plays the prosecutor in that, is like, no, 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 you are not ready for amends yet. You don't know what you're doing. And then we see a scene of her like trying to do it anyway, where it's like, I'm really sorry, but... And when she's telling her sponsor after, it's like, yeah, that's not how it goes. Like, this is later in your steps. Like, you have to work up to this by understanding.
It's in the second half of the steps.
Right.
For a reason.
Mm-hmm.
You think you're ready to, like, negotiate, and you aren't.
Yeah. So anyway, plug for Single Drunk
Female.
I'm going
to go get some gin because I don't know that much about it either. I'm just saying.
Well, I mean, that does make sense because she's in a bar working. So, you know, she would need to get gin. Anyway, the next day, Allison bounces by Jane's place. Jane has been busy. Clip 11.
So busy you don't have time for your best friend?
What?
Or am I wrong about that? Right now, my best friend is me.
Oh, come on, Jane.
You can't stop people from caring.
You're boring.
Look, you've been through an incredible trauma, and Jake and I want to be there for you.
Well, maybe you two need to get a life, or at least find someone else to obsess on. Hell, maybe you and Jake should date each other. That way you'd both be off my back.
This is just misdirected anger, Jane. I know you still have feelings for him.
Right now, I feel nothing for Jake. And frankly, I don't feel a hell of a lot for you either.
Gasp.
I mean... Okay.
Yeah, well, Allison earned that by being all up in her business and being a bad friend.
Mm-hmm.
Jake aside, like the Jake factor of, you know, possibly being close to hooking up with Jane's ex is a whole separate issue. Like her direct interactions with Jane were pretty shitty too, as we discussed.
Yeah.
So Jane and her neckerchief, which sidebar, so much neckerchief on Jane in this episode, and I do not approve.
Yeah.
They return to the store where Samantha works to talk about buying the place. And the owner, whose name is Margot, is supposedly a fan of Jane's designs, LOL, and says someone else has already made an offer on the store. Jane asks the number that beat, and the owner reminds her that it would be illegal for her to say, which I'm sure is true, and I'm sure also happens all the time, by the way. And when we see Jane and Samantha next, they're out for coffee behind Margot's back, and they are 100% at Equator, the gay coffee house from 90210, where Steve saw gay Mike being gay. You can see the side-by-side in the visual aids because I did go back to that episode and checked and confirmed. You're welcome. Jane wants Samantha to stay on as assistant manager, but Samantha's leaving the city. She broke up with her boyfriend and he kept their apartment. And even without a raise, she couldn't afford a place of her own. Jane could use a roommate and guarantee Samantha a raise, which, I don't know, man, a store owner who has a roommate doesn't seem like she's got budgeting skills I would feel comfortable risking my career on. But
had the same thought.
Yeah. All of this is contingent on Jane beating the other offer anyway, and Samantha doesn't think it would be ethical to tell her what it is. I don't think Margot should have told Samantha what the other offer even was, but anyway.
No, she's a clerk. Like, you're the owner.
Mm-mm.
Maybe keep that to yourself.
But anyway, if Jane wins, Margot gets more money, Samantha gets to work for Jane, and the other party finds another location. Samantha's unconvinced, but when Jane passes her a pen and a napkin, Samantha writes it down. It's $197,500 if you're writing a book. Meanwhile, at Shooters, Sydney tries to get Jake on side with her and looking after Jane. This is the sleeveless ringer, by the way, the sleeveless ringer scene. You can see in the visual aids. When Jake snits that Jane prefers the company of a rapist to Jake's, Sydney asks whether he doesn't think that's strange. And when Jake asks straight out what rash thing Sydney wants him to talk Jane out of, she dodges again. And Jake declares that Jane's on her own. And after Sydney's left, Allison asks Jake out to a movie. Jake, very formally for someone who is letting Allison put his drunk ass to bed within the last week on the show, says he thinks lines sometimes get blurred, but as her employer, he should not accept her invitation. And she wants to know why he can't be as good a friend to her as he is to Billy. And he says Allison could ask any of her other neighbors to a movie, which, like, yes, but it might interest either of them to know other people live in Los Angeles outside of the Melrose Place gate. They like movies also, like, make them friends.
Or just go to the fucking movie by yourself.
Go by yourself. Baby.
Ugh. Yeah.
I mean, going to the movies by yourself, underrated pleasure. Don't have to share any of your snacks. It's the best.
So underrated.
Jake adds that he doesn't need the complication of all this. Allison didn't realize friendship was a complication, but now she knows.
Ooh.
Billy is a friend to Jake and Allison's just an employee. And Jake's like, yup.
And this is like fucking groundhog fight. It happens like four times over the last episode and a half. Like, just a fuck.
Yeah, it's true. After the commercials, Jane has brought Sydney, who has caught the neckerchief virus since we saw her last, to the shop to say she's about to be its owner. Margot comes out for the back to say Jane somehow managed to inch out her competition. Sydney guesses this means Jane will be dropping everything else and focusing on the shop. Hint. But Jane still has a few odds and ends to take care of and makes the down payment in cash. Nothing suspicious about that.
Scuzzy cash, too. It looks like she had a bake sale and bundled a bunch of fives. Like, okay.
Yeah. So that night, Jake and Allison are left alone at Shooters. He tries to walk back what he said about their friendship. She says he can make it up to her by dancing, and he relents, but only for a second before telling her she should direct this attention at Billy. She, as she has said 5,000 times, is not interested in Billy anymore and stares at Jake's mouth while saying so. He then actually lets go of her all flustered, which is when Billy walks in. Jake says he was about to send Allison home and Billy offers to walk her, which she declines. She's going to stay in case it gets busy again. And when she's wandered off, Billy thanks Jake for trying to convince Allison to take him back just to twist the knife, blah, blah. We get it. The next day, Sydney is dubious about Jane getting a roommate, and not because her place is a one-bedroom, by the way, but it is. And when Jane goes to get dressed, Sydney crabbily answers a knock at the door. It is Richard, who doesn't wait to be invited in and helps himself to coffee. And Sydney avoids his gaze as he tries to make small talk, but then claims he's looking pale and must be working too much. He needs a vacation. And Jane hears this and enters to kick Richard out and yell at Sydney with arm grab, in the process of which Jane says this, clip 12.
Why are you having such a hard time with this?
Okay. I have a story about this. So when Dave and I had first moved to New York, we lived in a one-bedroom apartment, which was, we think, between 600 and 700 square feet. Big for New York, not big. In, you know, in absolute
in the
terms.
World. Right.
Yes. At the time, we still had a corporation in Canada. And so there were like some boxes of papers or whatever, like just shit you have to keep that were, you know, after we sold our house there, we needed to put them somewhere. And my sister had a house that was two stories plus a basement and a garage, which they didn't park in. It was just more storage. So I asked her if she would like, if we could just keep those boxes there. And for some reason, she, like, really dug her heels in. I know she doesn't listen to this podcast, so that's why I'm telling the story, although she would agree all of this is true. And so both of us were, like, similarly, like, I don't know why you're asking me this. I don't know why you're saying no. And that is the appropriate thing to say. Why are you having such a hard time with this?
Storing my tax records.
Yes. Yeah. Not participating in my murder plot, Jane.
which I blackmailed you into because you drugged me and gave me a stroke.
Yes.
I mean, when you put it like that.
Yeah. So Sydney can't believe Jane wants to live in a world where someone like Sydney has stronger morals than Jane, but Jane is fine with that if Richard isn't there.
I mean, same.
Sure.
She's making some strong points, mm-hmm. I'm just saying.
At the studio, Richard asks if Jane has come across any loose checks. The accountant says 9 are missing from the back of this checkbook. Burns and Mancini Medical Group needs to hire this attentive king of an accountant because Sydney has really been embezzling a lot, and that has never come up. There's been no comeuppance for her with all of that.
I think they just forgot about it. And also, I don't think I understand, like, is Jane's end game that once Richard is dead, this will cease to, like, the embezzlement will cease to matter?
Yes.
Okay.
Because she'll shut down the company, I assume, and just, like, liquidate it.
Right. Okay.
You know?
Yeah.
So Jane convincingly says she doesn't get involved in that side of the business and doesn't have access to the check, but he remembers that she did when he was in his office last week, and she decides to flirt her way out of it, which is, unfortunately, right when Jake shows up and sees. And Jane tells Jake again that it's over between them, and Jake is like, fine, but you can't be into Richard, and Jane very cleverly says this, clip 13.
My every waking thought is of Richard. I am completely focused on him.
Satisfying.
And you can see this in the visual aids. It does look like she's trying to send a message to Jake's mind, but it doesn't make it all the way there.
No, it doesn't.
No. Later, Allison comes to Jake's office to try to cheer him up, but he's already halfway through a bottle of tequila and combative, clip 14.
Let me guess. This is where you stick your nose in my business and get all empathetic, right?
Excuse me, Jake, but we are friends. I'm allowed to ask why you're hurting.
Friend, right? And why have you been throwing yourself at me?
If you want to get tanked and imagine things, that's fine. But I don't want to participate.
Oh, yeah? Then why'd you come in here? You want me to do you right here on the desk?
Jake.
I don't know. I keep trying to be a nice guy, and it seems all you women want is someone to treat you like trash.
This is not about me.
It's all about you. You got a good guy in Billy. He loves you, he wants to treat you right, but you gotta come sniffing around me, don't you?
I'm gonna forget this conversation ever happened.
No, I don't want you to forget. I'm not interested in you. You get that? I'm not interested. Now get out of here.
Methinks the lunkhead protests too much.
Ugh. Sniffing around is such a disgusting phrase for
and
this
also,
situation.
Do you? Just, I Ugh. Mean, just yeah. fuck. I'm aging.
Yeah, they really have made Jake absolutely unbearable in a very short period of time.
Yeah.
Like, well done.
Yeah. And even though it's inconsistent writing and it's not totally his fault, like, do not want.
No.
And they're still trying it with the Caesar, like intermittently. They'll just like water it and paste it down. It'll flip up on the side. Like, guys, just buzz it all off. He has the cheekbones. It's going to be okay.
Yeah.
We'll get through this as a country.
So the next morning, Billy's waiting on the stairs when Allison comes down for a run. She wearily says she's not in the mood to hear how great he is for her. And he's like, I totally get it. But FYI, I have been working on myself. Just ask me. And Allison even more wearily congratulates him for growing up. But when she tries to leave again, he asks her out again, just as Jake sticks his head out of his place to get the paper, which apparently convinces Allison to accept Billy's invitation. When she finally leaves, Billy goes over to tell an audibly hungover Jake the good news. Cut to a cell in what is more obviously a Sydney dream than last time, with the goons tying Bobby up to the bed.
Oh, R.I.P.
Yeah, we miss him. In this one,
I do actually miss it.
I do a little. He was really hot at the end. Anyway, Sydney and Jane are waiting to be executed while Jane houses her last meal. As you can see in the visual aids, like, there are lobsters.
Yeah, I felt seen.
It's time to go. Sydney babbles to the guards that she didn't want to kill Richard. Jane blackmailed her. She doesn't want to go to hell. And Jane says, clip 15.
Shut up, Sydney, and take your gas like a man!
I don't know why I rewound that like 15 times and I laughed and laughed. Like there's this like Mr. Hepburn thing. Take your gas like a man.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God. It's so good. Like
it's Josie
Bassett is not great. But like overall, but she's mm-hmm. been very good in this plot line.
Yeah.
I think it's sort of until the wheels really come off it at the end because they're stalling.
Yep.
But she's also having a great time, and I respect that. Take mm-hmm. your gas like a man. Like, what what direction was that? That was no direction, I think, and I did not hate it.
No, it was great. So Sydney screams in the dream and then wakes up screaming and tells Jane they were dead sisters walking, episode title. Jane tells her it was just a dream, and she throws Sydney's all-black prowler wear at her and says that because Richard knows about the money, the murder's on for the next night. Sydney tries to get. Yeah.
Can we talk now about the prowler wear or should we wait?
No, we can talk about it now. Yeah. When we see it on them, we see they're both in like microfiber trenches that are a tiny bit shiny, which is
they're
very
satiny.
Of the era.
It's like a Steve Madden slide was made into a trench and it's like murder gear, but make it fashion.
Yeah.
Like, guys. And then they're both in full makeup. Like, guys, I know it's TV, but guys.
Yeah. And Sydney gets the toque, or the whatever you call them in America, stocking cap. But Jane, the blonde, is just in a beret that's, like, stylishly on her head. Okay.
I know, like, what are we? Fine.
Anywho, Sydney tries to get Jane to read the Bible with her, but the higher power Jane is depending on is Smith & Wesson. Also, clip 16.
I'll pick you up at 6. We'll have dinner first.
Oh, that's not so bad.
I don't. And like, not that Sydney doesn't point this out at dinner, but it's like, we'll have dinner first. Like, it's not the theater.
No.
Have dinner after, like on The Sopranos. This is how it's done. These are professionals. Come on.
Yeah, see, if you have dinner before, you're going to barf.
Exactly. Or like, what if you have to poo?
Yes. Think it through. Come on.
Also, something we learned from The Sopranos, don't eat before you have to go do a safe-cracking job, because then you'll have to poop in a bucket.
Yep.
Anyway.
Anyway.
This has been felonious poop talk.
It took a while. We finally got there. At Shooters, Allison and Jake have a testy conversation about her date with Billy that night.
No.
And she admits he did her a favor. She was starting to feel something for Jake, but he saved her wasting her time and overlooking someone who does have feelings for her. And meanwhile, in a booth, Jane and Sydney are in their aforementioned crime outfits. Jane, housing fries. Sydney hasn't even taken her up on that dinner, apparently. She's just has a drink. And Jane goes to the can and asks Sydney to watch her purse. Dumb. Sydney slides the purse off the table, exposes the gun, looks around shiftily. Jane calls Richard from the payphone to make sure they're still on at his place that night. He's been thinking about it all day. She can't wait to see his face. And Sydney is still trying to talk her way out of this when Jane parks outside of Richard's house. Apparently, Sydney's only job is to be Jane's getaway driver, and she obviously can't talk Jane out of her plan. And when Richard pulls in, Jane's hiding in some bushes, but steps out when he is about to unlock the side door. Clip 17.
Jane. You really? Should we get inside?
I'd rather die first. Or better yet, I'd rather you die.
What are you up to?
Pulls the gun.
Jane, don't do anything stupid, okay?
Get down on your knees.
Why are you doing this? What the hell do you want from me?
What do I want? I want you to admit you're a rapist. I want to see the fear in your eyes. I want you to beg for my mercy.
I'm not begging for anything, bitch.
I'm waiting. Beg.
You're gonna regret this.
Say it. You either say it to me or you say it to God. Either way, you're dead.
Okay, look. Don't shoot.
Say it!
Don't shoot, okay? Yes. I raped you, okay? I swear to God, I'll never do it again. Do you forgive me? Jane, please don't kill me. Now give me the gun.
I'll never do it again? Oh, okay. Like, what? Mm.
Yeah, I have to wonder what her plan actually was.
Right.
Like, you know, given that she thought something was true that was not true, which we'll hear about in a second, but yeah.
So, he tries to take it. She orders him to stay still. And when she finally pulls the trigger, nothing happens. Oh, Sydney, you emptied the gun. Richard's smug face, which you can see in the visual aids, is really too much. So he grabs her and pushes her down on a pile of building materials, which, like, I don't know what Sydney thought was going to happen. Obviously this, as Jane screams for her. And Richard is about to try to sexually assault Jane again when Sydney brains him with a shovel and knocks him out. She's sorry about the bullets, but she stopped him, apparently permanently, because when Jane checks his pulse, she can't find one. And after the commercial, Sydney's suggesting making it look like a mugging, but Jane doesn't think anyone would believe that, given the shovel. And Jane decides they're just going to bury him somewhere no one will ever find him. So then Jake comes to Allison's before her date to deliver her paycheck by way of apology. And since he's there, could he zip her dress? And it's a charged moment for them both. And then she's like, it's not just me, is it? And he says, it doesn't matter what he feels. Billy's waiting for her. And she wants to know, is he waiting for Jane? Not anymore, he says. And as he leans in, she says they shouldn't do that. He agrees, but they do it anyway and finally fucking kiss. That's fucking kiss, not fuck and kiss. They finally fucking kiss.
And we assume fuck.
Well, we do, because then we cut to Billy's overly fussy.
You know who's also fucked? Billy.
That's right. Oh. So Billy has chosen an extremely fussy restaurant where he waits at the table and endures a violinist playing just for him. And we learn he rented out the whole joint for this date. Good Lord, man.
Oh, dude.
So then Sydney drives Jane into the middle of nowhere, parks, and resigns herself to dealing with the situation while Jane sits frozen in the passenger seat saying she can't do it, but eventually lets Sydney bark her out of the car. And Jane is pulled up short again by the sight of Richard in the back. Clip 18.
You murdered him.
Correction. We murdered him. All right. I'll grab his head. You can grab his feet. Anytime, Jane.
Yeah, this is infuriating, actually. I am infuriated on Sydney's behalf that it's like, to snap out of it, seriously.
Well, after all of the 5,000 times I told you I didn't want to do this, and you insisted on going through with it anyway, and now you're not even dealing with it? Come on now.
Yeah. And, like, I'm the small one. Like, the two of us make one of him.
Yeah.
You have to help.
Mm-hmm. Ugh. So Sydney basically has to bull Jane through every phase of the process. Richard is heavy. It's all very awkward, ending this scene with Sydney pushing Richard down a little hill. And when we rejoin them later, burial is going slowly and Jane is not helping. And they hear a branch snap, but not its source, and they agree they need to leave. But just as Sydney has patted down the last of the dirt on him, Jane decides Richard isn't buried deep enough, which, like, she just finished. It's gonna have to do. And Sydney, fully over all of this, chucks the shovel nearby the corpse, which presumably has, like, DNA on it, while Jane loses it. Clip 19.
He must be so cold.
Trust me, Jane. He doesn't care.
No one does. It's an hour and 29 minutes into this shit. Like,
yeah.
Please get to the moment that I've been waiting for since this character showed up.
And here it is. They drive off, and then we cut back to the mound, and a hand pops out of the grave!
Chills. Like, knew it was going to happen. It's so cheesy. It's telegraphed for, like, 10 minutes.
Yeah.
But I mean, that hand, oh, it's so good. It's so good.
I made a I made a GIF you can see in the visual aids. It's like it. I had to cut it down from how much of it you actually see. Like it just it pops out and then it like things around a little bit. Thing it from the
totally
Adam family.
Things around. It's so thingy. Oh my god.
Yeah. It's very good. And that's season four. So let's close it up, first of all, by naming our episode MVP. Sydney. She rose to a terrible occasion.
Looked great. And didn't bury him deep enough that he couldn't get out, I guess. Yay.
Yeah.
Might help her at trial.
I guess, yeah, if that was, I mean, if that was the point, I suppose. All right, least valuable player. I mean, clearly Richard the Rapist, but aside from him, I'm going to say Dave, I mean, not effective.
Yeah, props was not great. I'm going to go with O'Malley. Like, just get out.
Go, just go.
Bye.
Hurry up and go.
Mm-hmm.
All right, before we get to our season MVP and LVP, I just want to jump over to our Discord because as we've been approaching the end of the season, there's been a lot of talk was like, that was this season? That was this season? So one of our listeners, Erica, posted last week, by the time you hear this, in anticipation of the season finale, a quick poll. Which event are you most surprised to remember happened this season? A, Allison's real blindness and then fake blindness. B, Matt versus Paul / Matt punching Jake in the face. C, the amazing Amanda portrait. Oh, God. D, Richard and Jane getting engaged and also, whoops, here's Joe. E, the Shelley of it all. Fucking remember Shelley?
Yes. I mean, Shelley. No, but yes.
Yeah. Shelley. F, Michael and Sydney hiring a guy to pretend to be Schmob. G, Schmob. Updated thanks to... user C-Kent, C-E-K-E-N-E-N-T. Allison marrying Haley / being widowed of same. I'm also going to throw in, what was Amanda's ex's name? Jack. Jack Parisi, like appearing and dying.
Like, yeah. And all of Parisi that. Senior and yes. Bobby. Oh, God.
Yes. All of the Parisi business.
Business.
It's been a long, real long season, you guys. So thank you to Erica for this list, because a lot of people are like, holy shit, what? And it's true. Like,
yeah, and also Brooke Rise, Brooke Set.
Right.
I mean.
Yeah. Yes. Yeesh. So God bless. And this is the Discord is a perk that you can get by joining the Patreon at any level of support. So patreon.com/againwiththis to get in on that Discord and other discussions of that sort. So let's start with our season MVP. Ooh.
Yeah.
That's a...
Michael?
Michael's always a reliable choice, and he's been pretty good. I mean,
yeah.
He's... I can't remember him trying to kill anyone. That's not to say he
didn't. Should have checked Denise Richards' ID.
Yeah.
Technically, he stat raped somebody, but...
Right. He did. Yeah, I think that's fair. I'm gonna say Amanda, because she really went through some shit and she remained above most of the fray. Like she was okay considering what she was attached to. You know, she never actually did get arrested.
Honorable mention to Chris, still at large.
All right, our season least valuable player. Leaving aside Richard, because I feel like blah, blah.
Yeah.
Billy has just sucked the whole time.
Yeah. Yep.
Like, truly, from start to finish, he's been...
He did. Yeah.
Absolutely
wire to wire
terrible.
Suckage. Yep, yeah, it's true.
All right. We did it! Season four in the books!
In the books. Next time on Again With This, it's Beverly Hills 90210 Secondary Character Thunderdome. 18 characters, 3 rounds, 1 winner, hundreds of gallons of blood shed. Place your bets now. And place some cucumber slices on your eyes to prep for the season finale visual aids, which you'll find for this and every other episode of Again With This at againwiththispodcast.com. That's also where you can find links to our very special 90210 book.
Follow us on Twitter at AWT90210 and join our Patreon page at patreon.com/againwiththis. Any level of support gets you access to the Discord and extra episodes, 80-odd extra episodes.
Yeah.
I'm Deus Ex Bosnia Sarah D. Buntig, and I'm on Twitter at Tomato Nation. Thank you. I was proud of that one. My co-host is Death Row Dream Sequence Tara Ariano, and she's on Twitter at Tara Ariano. And our producer is Manos Hand of Dick, David T. Cole. Talk to you next time.
End of the line, psychos.